Hi, I'm Armin Alme. The U.S. Supreme Court is supposed to be beyond partisanship, but of course, some court rulings have political impact for decades. And now, we have two examples of how that happens. Two decisions expected this month. There'll be a test of Chief Justice John Roberts. He claims the court is impartial, but he's a Republican appointee with a very conservative background.
There is this tremendous opportunity to reshape the law in the direction that he would like. And on the other hand, he knows that if things are done in that direction, that the court is going to be seen as an even more of a political institution than it is now.
That's Rick Hassan. He's professor of law and political science at the University of California at Irvine. He's author of Plutocrats United, subtitled in part, The Supreme Court and the Distortion of America's Elections. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Let's start with the issue that involves the census, which is called the gold standard body of statistics that make the country run. What does that mean? What is the census? Where does it come from?
Well, so the Constitution requires that all of the people of the United States are counted every 10 years. And this is really the largest peacetime undertaking in the United States. It's a massive operation to try to count everyone and collect some basic information about them. And the two primary uses of the census is one, to apportion the number of members of Congress among the states, because that's basically done more or less on the basis of population, with each state guaranteed at least one member of Congress and then the rest done by population, and also to dole out money based upon population. So if a state is getting federal assistance for something, how many people determines how much money they get. So it's very important for the states, both politically and economically.
The first census was held in 1790, as I understand it, and George Washington was worried about it. He said it wasn't accurate. So it's been political for a long, long time.
Well, and it's very difficult to try to count everyone, and it requires hiring thousands of people who are going to be literally going from block to block trying to collect information on people who have not returned forms. It'll start with a massive mailing. That mailing is going to start with some printing in July, which will bring us to the Supreme Court case we're going to talk about. But it's a process that takes a very long time. And even with that, we know it's not going to be perfectly accurate. And they're really trying to do the best they can in terms of counting the number of people in the United States.
And historically, there have been disputes about who, in fact, were going to be counted and what categories they would be in. There was, at the outset, the fact that some states had a lot of slaves, in fact, more slaves perhaps than others. And then after the Civil War, there were quadroons, people who had a quarter of black blood, and octoroons, who had an eighth of black blood. And those kinds of controversies obviously have been powerful in determining, as you indicated at the outset, who serves in Congress.
Sure. Well, so, when we had slavery, then, infamously, the Constitution counted slaves as three-fifths of a person.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was changed after the Civil War. But there have been questions, and there were questions even in the last census about categorizing people by race and whether there could be a mixed-race category, which they added in. You know, that information is important demographically and trying to understand the picture of who the people are in each of these states. Now we count all persons, but we still collect other information along the way.
Okay. Now, back to the issue of categories. The argument before the court right now has to do with the Trump administration, which wants to include in the census a question about citizenship. How is that so controversial, and what are the consequences of a potential decision?
Sure. So there are different questions that get asked on each census, and the typical way that new questions are added to the census is that there's a period of research. They do test questions. They try to figure out the best wording, and they know that questions they ask could affect people's willingness to answer the census. This question that was put on did not go through that normal process. The story that the Commerce Department is telling is one that the Department of Justice came to the Commerce Department and asked for the inclusion of the census question, the citizenship question on the census, in order to help the Department of Justice in litigating Voting Rights Act cases on behalf of Latino voters, where information about the so-called citizen voting age population, or CVAP, is relevant in drawing Latino majority districts. That was the official story. It turns out that the truth seems to be very far from that. The truth seems to be that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, came in after discussions with apparently candidate Trump, Steve Bannon, and Chris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas and a anti-immigrant crusader, came in, wanted this question, and essentially maneuvered to eventually get the Department of Justice to ask the Commerce Department to include the question. And so one of the key questions before the Supreme Court is whether when the Census Bureau decided to include the question, whether that was an arbitrary and capricious action in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act. That's the kind of the technical issue. Basically, did they have a good reason for including this? And what three different courts found is that the reason that was given by the government, that they were trying to help these Latino voters in Voting Rights Act lawsuits, was a pretext. That wasn't the truth. Whatever the motivation was, it was not to help Latino voters. And that's the question before the Supreme Court. And just in the last few weeks, as we can talk about, some new information came out as to what the actual motivation may have been.
And that has to do with a dead man's hard drive revealed by his daughter after he was deceased. You've said that it would be difficult to produce a greater smoking gun than this. Tell us about that.
So there was a guy who was one of the redistricting gurus working for the Republican Party named Thomas Hoeffler, and he drew the district lines in North Carolina. He had his hand in redistricting in different places around the country. He was famous for going around giving lectures to Republican legislators and telling them, you know, don't put anything in writing. It's really important that you don't have any emails that could later be brought up in court. You know, you should use a secure phone. And then ironically, he passed away. His estranged daughter, who is politically not aligned with him, was able to get a hold of his hard drive and a number of thumb drives and offered to turn them over to Common Cause, and they've now found their way into the census litigation as well as into litigation in North Carolina over a redistricting case. And in terms of the census case, the claim is that the inclusion of the citizenship question started with a memo that Hoeffler had written saying that if you include a citizenship question in the census, what you would be able to do is draw districts, so we'll talk about, say, the state of Texas. Within the state of Texas, for Congress or for the state legislature, you might be able to draw districts under what's called the one-person, one-vote standard, where we have, you know, equal-sized districts. Rather than putting equal numbers of people in them, you might draw them with only equal numbers of voter-eligible people, which means we'd exclude children, we'd exclude felons, who are not allowed to vote, and we'd exclude non-citizens. If you did the drawing in this way, you would increase white Republican power to the exclusion of Latinos and Democrats. And so this document that Hoeffler created ended up in the hands of someone at the Department of Justice, and the claim of the plaintiffs in one of the census cases is that it was really the basis for why Wilbur Ross ended up wanting to include the citizenship question. Quite the opposite, the story of including the question to help Latinos, but is actually meant as a means of hurting them.
Okay, so that's what the Supreme Court is dealing with. That's not the only ruling that's coming up on Decision Day, sometime around the end of this month, that has to do with politics. The census case is just one. The other has to do with what's called gerrymandering. Michael Lee is Senior Counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, people hear the word gerrymandering. Tell us a little bit before we get to the case what that's about.
So gerrymandering is a term that we use in the United States to describe the political manipulation of districts for the benefit of a political party or for incumbent lawmakers or a candidate for office. And it dates back to 1812 in an infamous map that was signed into law by Governor Elbert Gerry. He pronounced his last name Gerry, so it probably should actually technically be gerrymandering.
Gerry, not Jerry. Okay.
But everybody pronounces it gerrymandering. But the practice really even goes back well before that, back to the fact the founding of the nation. Patrick Henry of Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death fame was a great patriot, but he also was governor of Virginia when it came time to draw Virginia's very first congressional districts, and he hated with a vengeance a man named James Madison and tried to draw the map in a way that Madison couldn't win. So perhaps, you know, like this should actually be called Henrymandering or something like that. But in any event, we're stuck with gerrymandering. And it's something that's been with us for a long time, but it's definitely a practice that is getting worse. And it's getting worse for a couple of reasons, several reasons. But the two of the biggest are that, map drawers now have at their disposal more powerful technology and more powerful data to put in that technology in which to draw maps. It used to be when you were drawing maps by hand, you could draw three or four maps and you would take the best of those for your party. But now with computers, you can draw literally tens of thousands of maps and pick the best set of those. And on top of that, you have more powerful data. And this is data that companies and campaigns use, but it's based on your Google searches, your credit score, what kind of car you drive, all of that stuff goes in there, and it creates a profile about who you are as a voter. And that makes it possible to go down the street and really strategically pick out your voters and to draw districts in a way such that they never flip, and to draw maps that are wildly unrepresentative. So, for example, in North Carolina, which is a 50-50 state, you have maps that give Republicans 10 out of the 13 seats, so a 10-3 advantage in a state that's 50-50. You saw something similar in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, where, again, they're roughly 50-50 at a statewide level, but the maps are drawn to give Republicans an outsized advantage.
And I have to tell you that in California, as long ago as the 1970s, I remember very well that the Berman machine, as it was called, a Democratic organization, really began to make this a very sophisticated operation. And they were drawing district boundaries, as you say, that go, you know, Democratic on one side of the street and Republican on the other, and turn here and turn there. And they got very good at it. So it's something that both parties have used.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I should say, like, Republicans did more of it after the 2011 round of redistricting, only because that came right after the Tea Party wave in 2010, when they won control of a bunch of states, oftentimes funded. That was a very concerted effort to win those states in order to be able to gerrymander, but they were really successful. They benefited from a wave, and so they were able to draw lots of gerrymanders. There's no question that if the shoe were on the other foot, the Democrats would have done the same thing. It's just that Democrats turned out to be asleep at the wheel in 2010 when it came to the elections.
How does this apply in North Carolina in the current case that the Supreme Court is deciding now?
So the Supreme Court has never put partisan gerrymandering clearly out of bounds in the way that it's put discriminating on the basis of race or racial gerrymandering out of bounds. And that's led at times to sort of this odd anomaly where people will draw maps that wildly discriminate against people of color, but defend them on the grounds that, no, we weren't trying to discriminate against African Americans or Latinos. We were trying to discriminate against Democrats, and that's okay. And if they happen to be mostly black and brown, well, that's just a side consequence. In North Carolina, there is a case that will perhaps give the Supreme Court the opportunity for the very first time to say that partisan gerrymandering as well as racial gerrymandering are constitutionally prohibited. And it's a really closely watched case because, again, the Supreme Court over time has badly deadlocked on this issue in the 2000s and deadlocked in a way that most people thought, like, well, there really are no limits on gerrymandering. You can basically do whatever you want because the Supreme Court will never police it. We will get a really good chance to see whether the Supreme Court does that in North Carolina in part. And this is going to be a really great case because the facts in North Carolina are especially stark. The regional congressional map in North Carolina was struck down as a racial gerrymander, and the legislature was ordered to redraw it, and the lawmakers came back and said, well, we can't racial gerrymander, but we're going to do a political gerrymander, and that's not illegal. Those are almost literally their words. And they put in writing that they would not consider any map unless it had at least 10 Republican districts out of the 13. And so you really don't have a better set of facts than North Carolina. And while the Supreme Court in the past has sort of dodged this issue in various ways, you know, there's a lot of thinking that it's really hard for them to, you know, say that somehow North Carolina is okay. Now, they could pump the issue or you know, decide not to decide the issue. But, it's in a lot of ways really hard to say that North Carolina is somehow okay. And that's at least the hope of a lot of people.
Okay, so we have the case having to do with the Senate, and we have the case having to do with gerrymandering now before the U.S. Supreme Court, scheduled for rulings to be announced on Decision Day later this month. And we're talking with Rick Hassan and Michael Lee. I want to come back and talk to you both about how these cases are intertwined and what the combination of these two might, in fact, leave us with. This is To the Point, and we'll be right back.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we're only back with To the Point, talking today about a couple of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court that may have a lot to do with politics in the United States for years to come. And Rick Hassan, let me go back to you again at the University of California, Irvine. How do these two cases, the North Carolina case on redistricting and the case we heard about earlier having to do with the census, how do they intertwine? How do they work together?
Sure. Well, first thing I would say is that there's another case and that actually might be relevant, which is there's a Maryland case as well involving gerrymandering. Supreme Court heard them both on the same day. One difference in the Maryland case is that it was the Democrats that were engaged in gerrymandering, and it also involved congressional districts rather than state districts. So that may be relevant for this reason. It would look very political and partisan if the Supreme Court sides with Republicans throughout. At the most extreme, it finds that the Maryland gerrymander is unconstitutional, the North Carolina one is fine, and the citizenship question is fine. I don't think that's likely to happen. I think the North Carolina and Maryland cases will be decided as a pair. But even so, we're now in a situation, really for the first time, where all of the conservative justices on the Supreme Court were appointed by Republican presidents, and all of the liberals on the court were appointed by Democratic presidents. So it's now possible to talk about the Republican majority on the Supreme Court in a way that it wasn't before, where you had justices like Justice Stevens or Souter, who were Republicans who were leaning liberal, or Justice White, who was a Democrat who leaned conservative, at least on some issues. There was this point where John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, came out against a statement Donald Trump made about Obama judges and says, there are no Trump judges, there are no Obama judges, there are just judges. And he really kind of trying to be an institutionalist. So on the one hand, John Roberts, who now with Justice Kennedy's retirement sits in the middle of the court as the swing or median justice. On the one hand, institutionally, I think John Roberts wants the court to look like it's not another political body. On the other hand, he's quite conservative, as are the other members of the majority, and it sounded like at oral argument that they were likely to side with the government on the census citizenship question. If they decide both the citizenship question and the gerrymandering question in ways favored by Republican elites, they're going to look more like a Republican court. And so maybe for that reason, there's a better than normal chance that the court will rein in partisan gerrymandering precisely because they don't want to have this. So if they're going to side with the Trump administration on the census question, they might end up siding with the plaintiffs in the gerrymandering case.
Michael Lee, how long a period of American politics might be affected one way or the other by the way the court goes?
On the gerrymandering case, I think this is, like, in some ways a do or die moment. If there is the risk that the court, walks away from the issue or decides the cases in a way that is really narrow and really doesn't do much, right? And if that's the case, then there really won't be federal protections against gerrymandering. And I think, I mentioned earlier this new proliferation of big data and technology. People now have, the equivalent of an AR-15, and the Supreme Court basically could say, there will be no police officers on the street, right? And if that happens, then, you can fully expect there to be a burst of gerrymandering, unlike anything that we've seen before, locking in majorities that are anti-democratic and non-representative for the course of a decade, basically rendering elections meaningless, which, if you think about it, is exactly the opposite of what the framers would have wanted. The reason we have elections every 2 years, much more frequently than other countries, is the framers thought that Congress, they thought that legislature should look like the people as a whole. And Madison talked about the Congress being an exact portrait, a miniature of the people. But that doesn't happen when you rig these elections, and the Supreme Court really could be greenlighting all of that. So it's a really dangerous moment for the country in a lot of ways because this is something, there certainly is a possibility of reform in the states, but it would be really helpful for those efforts if people also knew that there, was some federal law out there.
And Rick Hassan, depending on how the census decision goes, how might it impact politics and the whole issue of redistribution of districts and gerrymandering?
Well, I think that there are two ways in which the citizenship question could have an effect on politics, both of which would help the Republican Party and would hurt Latino and Democratic interests. First, the Census Bureau's own experts had evidence that the citizenship question will deter response rates, especially among Hispanics. Fear that the government is going to use the data in a way to for immigration purposes or for other purposes. At the beginning, there's the concern about the response rate being lower. So if in California or other places where there may be large Latino populations, if there's an undercount, that could affect how many congressional seats we get in the state of California. It would also affect the kind of resources that would be available to California based for anything coming from the federal government that's based on a formula set to population. So that's part one. Part two is the part about this issue that the Supreme Court left open a few years ago about the ability of cities and states to do redistricting using only the numbers of eligible voters in each district. This is really the next shoe to drop in the next census. It's possible that Texas is going to come in, for example, and start to say, well, we're going to use this data about citizenship to draw voter-eligible districts. That would shift political power in states like Texas from the cities to the rural areas, from Latino Democratic districts to white Republican districts. So it could have pretty profound effects, and I think maybe even greater effects if that were to happen than we've seen with the kind of partisan gerrymandering that Michael was talking about.
So in other words, if in fact you weren't going to count non-citizens, you would have a lower population than you in fact do, and the amount of resources available from the federal government to deal with whatever issues that creates just simply wouldn't be available.
That's right, and it would be skewed in favor of one political party and the white racial group, and that is whether or not you should ultimately be able to draw districts with just voter eligible peoples. That's something that's been debated for decades among scholars and others. But if your purpose in doing that is to hurt an ethnic group or to hurt a political party, that seems to be constitutionally suspect. And it's not clear. We talked about that material on the hard drive. That material is not officially before the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court doesn't find facts. And so it's not clear if they're even going to legally be able to take account of what was actually the motivation behind including this question in the census.
Michael Lee, what about the argument against citizens' commissions to draw up boundaries? In California, we have one of those. The voters determined that we weren't going to do this on a on the same basis as in the past, and so it's not the legislature's job anymore. It's a citizens' commission. Is that idea, A good one for getting around to partisanship? B, is it in question because the Constitution gives the right to draw district boundaries to the legislatures, not to the people?
Well, you know, California was a really big test of whether independent commissions would work. You know, commissions had been used in a number of states before California, but they were mostly small and less demographically complicated than California. And so the reforms that California voters approved in 2008 and 2010 were a big test. And it turns out that the commission worked really well in 2011. I think even people who were skeptical of the commission, they'll tell you that the commission was a B+, which, you know, is, you know.
That's high praise.
That's high praise, you know.
Yeah.
You know, California used to have some of the least responsive maps in the country. Democrats got their seats and Republicans got their seats and everybody, nothing ever happened. And that's totally changed under these new maps. As Democrats win more votes, they get more seats. And as Republicans win more votes, if that ever happens, they would win more seats, or if the Greens or anybody else. And so there's a lot of evidence that redistricting commissions work, and they're really popular around the country. Colorado adopted a commission. Michigan adopted a commission in 2018. Utah adopted an advisory commission that has a lot of independence to advise the legislature in 2018. And all of these measures passed with huge bipartisan support. I think the public really is hungry for these, in part because the evidence of California is that they work. At least they draw maps as well as legislatures do, and in many ways better. As to the argument about Congress giving the power only to legislatures, that is an issue that I think
the Constitution.
Well, it's in the Constitution, but you know the court had the chance to consider this a few years ago in a case out of Arizona, and the Arizona Constitution allows the people to legislate, and that's what happened in California. There's some thought that that may be revisited. I think Rick might have a slightly different view than I do on the likelihood of that. But, because Justice Kennedy, who's now retired, was a fifth vote in a 5-4 case, and who knows whether that is the possibility. But, the reality is, I think, and I think the opinion in the Arizona case is a pretty good one. You know, the legislatures can legislate, and the people also can legislate in states where that's permissible. If you actually took the argument about that to its natural end, it also says that Congress can override, right? I mean, and things like that. And if a legislature literally means only the legislature, does it mean that the governor no longer can veto a bill? Does it mean that the president can no longer veto a bill when it comes to this area? I mean, there's a lot of sort of technical issues involved. And so that issue may yet come, but I am perhaps more confident that will remain the case.
Is this a question of whether voters choose their elected officials or whether elected politicians choose the voters? Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, and it's something that really sort of resonates with people. You know, you certainly saw it around the country in 2018 when people would go door to door in places like Michigan and Ohio collecting signatures for ballot initiatives, and they would go to Republican doors and they would go to Democratic doors, and everybody would sign the petition because all you had to do is say, we're going to take power out of the hands of politicians and give it back to the people. And, we really are at a moment in our country where there's a big distrust of institutional elites, whether those are politicians or whatever the case. And where people really think have understood that there's something broken in our country. They're not quite sure what it is, but they feel that redistricting and the rigging of districts is a big part of that. And that's why you saw, for example, when a reform measure was voted on in Ohio, it carried every single Ohio congressional district with a supermajority, Republican districts, Democratic districts. Anti-gerrymandering reform is much more popular than either Democrats or Republicans.
Rick Hassan, does Chief Justice Roberts appear to believe there's something broken at the Supreme Court?
Well, he's got his hands full right now because I think on the one hand, there is this tremendous opportunity to reshape the law in the direction that he would like. And on the other hand, he knows that if things are done in that direction, that the court is going to be seen as an even more of a political institution than it is now. And of course, this is happening at the same time that you have Donald Trump attacking the judiciary when it makes a decision he doesn't like, and Democrats upset with Republicans being able to get so many judges on the appeals courts and getting two justices on the Supreme Court after the blocking of Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. And so there's, you know, there's so much polarization around the court that it's really a high wire act. And, you know, you talk about whatever the issue is, whether it's immigration, and there may be a case about DACA coming on to the Supreme Court's docket next year, or it's abortion, or it's voting rights. And, you know, whenever I talk to people who work in these areas, they say, well, Roberts will see it here, and of course, this is where you know, he'll have to side with what's good for the country and not with his own ideology. And there's only so many times I think that liberals are going to be able to go to that well. Roberts is still a fundamentally conservative judge who has certain beliefs about the Constitution and how it should be read and how statutes should be read. And I think that people who put all their faith in John Roberts to save the court from being a political institution are probably being a little overly optimistic.
Michael Lee, Chief Justice Earl Warren historically managed to get a unanimous court on Brown versus the Board of Education, the integration of public schools, which, of course, was even more controversial, if that's possible, than what we're already talking about. How often has it been that there has been a justice who's been able to do that? And does Roberts appear to have that kind of authority with the current court?
Well, the Chief Justice certainly has tried to get as many unanimous or close to unanimous opinions as possible. You know, he's a big believer that, you know, that helps the institutional integrity of the court. He hasn't quite been as successful doing that in the political cases, of which I would say both the gerrymandering and the census case are. Those have tended to fall more along partisan lines, at least ultimately. But we will see. I mean, you know, I think that there is at least some hope, and I certainly would share this, that, you know, the gerrymandering case could end up being something more than a 5-4 decision. But, they will see this as a case where they need to send a message, whatever the message is, where it is something that is not just D's versus R's. Otherwise, you know, the risk is that the decision will be seen as a political decision and only that. And it will inject the Supreme Court into the current presidential debates even more than it already is. And in fact, you know, the decisions likely come out on the last week in June, exactly when the first Democratic presidential debate is supposed to occur in Miami.
Let me ask you both the same question. Rick Hassan, are these decisions likely to have an impact on next year's presidential election?
Well, you know, we're so far out from that. But one thing that we saw in the 2016 election is that people who thought the Supreme Court was one of the most important issues that they were voting on when they were choosing a presidential candidate broke 2-1 for Donald Trump. It's been a fact of life that the right has been much more excited and animated about the court, I think very much because of the issue of abortion leading the way, than the left has been. I think as the Roberts Court starts doing things that go against what many on the left think is, you know, the right way to read the Constitution and to interpret federal statutes, I think the issue of the Supreme Court is going to take greater prominence, if not in the 2020 elections, by 2024. You know, the Supreme Court moves kind of slowly. It's been slow walking some of these cases, like, you know, the cases about abortion rights. But eventually it's going to have to decide them. And when it does, if it does go break along ideological lines, then I think that it could become an issue on the left as it is on the right. We had a speech from Justice Ginsburg, one of the court's liberals, that she gave last week to the Second Circuit Judicial Conference, a group of judges in the area in the Northeast. And she talked about how momentous it was that Justice Kennedy left the court, because he was the swing justice. About 2/3 of the times he swung conservative and about one-third of the time liberal on the big issues. And now the court's not going to swing. She said it was a momentous change, and she talked about a lot of – she suggested a lot of 5-4 divisions are yet to come, I think, not just in this term, but in the terms looking forward.
Michael Lee, direct impact on the presidential election next year?
I certainly hope so. You know, when you go back to 2016, the name Merrick Garland did not come up at all during the Democratic National Convention that year. You know, and one party was really quite asleep at the wheel in terms of understanding the importance of the court, which is a little bit surprising given that how many justices on the liberal side are 80 or approaching 80. And so you would hope that we would have a robust discussion about the role of the court in society and these decisions, you know, particularly if they go you know, if they look like they're political decisions, I think we'll definitely be a part of that and fuel talk about how to fix the court in ways small and big.
Thanks very much to both of you for being with us, and we will all await the decisions of the court with great interest. Rick Hassin again at University of California, Irvine. His latest book is The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption. And Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Today's podcast produced by Andrea Brody with production assistance from John Reed, our engineer Chuck Prevetary. Make sure to check out our climate change update. Do kids have a constitutional right to a safe and livable planet? We'll hear from the plaintiff's lawyer who's suing the government and from a young woman in North Carolina who's calling for nationwide action. Don't forget to hit us up on social media. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave a review or contact me directly, warren.olney@kcrw.org. That's O-L-N-E-Y. Want to know what you think, what you'd like to hear. Meantime, join us again.